Hello, and welcome to Tolerable Risk, the podcast for NGO, nonprofit, and charity professionals who manage risk. I'm your host, Sabrina Siegel. Today, we're going to talk to Hussein Nasser Adin. Hussein is an experienced security consultant with extensive expertise in providing security and risk mitigation solutions to clients. His geographic area of focus is the Middle East and Africa, and he regularly advises corporations and organizations, including third sector organizations, on media crisis management, cash and asset protection, and preventative security measures. Hussein, I'm so happy to have you here on Tolerable Risk. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Hi, Sabrina. My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So today we're going to talk about personal security, physical security in the third sector. And a lot of times people might think immediately of crisis environments, refugee environments. And that is a lot of what we do. But there's also other organizations out there, local organizations maybe who are working with underrepresented communities, or maybe even just organizations out there who are working with animals or elderly people. So personal security and physical security is super important for all aspects of the third sector. And so I'm really looking forward to what you have to say today. But before we jump into that, can you just tell our listeners who aren't familiar with who you are or what you do a little bit more about yourself and your background?
Of course. So I'm Hussein Nasser Adin. I'm the CEO and co-founder of a company called Crownox Risk Mitigation Solutions. And we provide security solutions on different levels to international organizations and corporations operating mainly in the Middle East and North Africa. We interfere with everything from physical security to threat assessments, consultancies, and real-time intelligence as well. I was born and raised in East Jerusalem, and I have always been part of a continuous conflict. Therefore, risk mitigation has always been an interest for me. And across my academic path, I studied Middle East politics, and then I got my master's degree in homeland security, in addition to courses specialized in threat-related topics.
Thank you for that background, Hussein. And one of the reasons why I really wanted to have you on the show today is because you do have experience working with charities and nonprofits, some big ones, some medium-sized ones, some small ones. So it's not just the private sector that you have experience with. But I want to ask you this question, since you have experience on both sides of this in your area of work with personal and physical security, how does your expertise relate to risk management in the third sector? What are some experiences that you have or areas of focus that relate to work that charities and nonprofits do?
So when we look at the third sector, from my experience operating in a region that actually has a lot of need for charities and humanitarian agencies, they are heavily in the region. So when we look at the way they operate, the nature of such organizations, I always make a joke that most of our clients want to know where threats are, so they run away from them, while many from the third sector want to know where the threat is to run towards it, actually. For example, when you work with the UNRWA, who deals with refugees, or you operate with someone who is recording a specific misconduct or specific threats that are affecting communities within an unstable region, you would have to start operating according to the nature of their operations. So you can't tell people, don't do your job. Still, you need to maintain their safety and security. Here come our role. Specifically that as security experts with regional expertise, we have many layers that we always try to pass related to understanding culture, political complications, the uniqueness of the region we are actually in, and then security comes within those contexts. I think within the third sector, the need for such an in-depth understanding is much more than others, especially that you will want to still operate when crisis hits on a higher level, because usually people you care about, people you are serving, are much more affected during crisis and during higher threats on country levels, for example. So I believe that's the main importance and uniqueness between us as security experts and the sector, that you're the most vulnerable usually because you're the last one to leave when things are not really doing great on the security level.
Absolutely. Oh, I love what you said, Hussein, about how normally when crisis hits, people run away, but usually the third sector folks are the ones that run towards the threat, because that really encapsulates where people's hearts and minds are when they work in the charity sector. They want to help. They want to run towards whatever the problem is and try and fix it. I also love your point about it's not just about where are the safety threats, but it's about understanding the culture that you're working in and around, the political activities that are happening, and the unique context of where the work is happening. Now, this again could be in Sudan or in Ukraine, but it also could be in a different neighborhood in a city that maybe is suffering from violence or suffering from poverty, and there's a different operating context there as well. So I really like those three elements that you just pointed out. Let me ask you this question. So the type of work that you do in your technical area of specialty around physical security and personal security, what do you think people get wrong? What do they misunderstand about the type of work that you do?
I think people in general are affected by their perspective of different things. And when it comes to security, with the amount of TV shows and media and concepts around it, I think it's easy to misunderstand the exact value first and the way it should be done. So for example, people, when you speak about cross protection teams, let's go straight to this image people have in mind, individuals who actually are there to secure someone or an asset in a specific place, people would think always about those who are heavily equipped, big men, armed, big vehicles, maybe armored. And it's all about high profile, secured movement across threat. And this is an issue because people do actually act as if this is what's needed. So they invest more into equipment than into people. And when you go and take your, let's say, cross protection in hostile environments course, which is very similar to the HEAT course that many people within the third sector take, but for security specialists, the first thing you look at is scenarios, worst case scenarios of security issues that were not avoided, including, for example, assassinations. And the most interesting thing is that most of those scenarios had heavily equipped teams that are on governmental level, like where budgets were not an issue, where they had the full support. Still, what went wrong always is either communication or planning or understanding the threats in a specific geography. So insecurity, in my opinion, what people have to understand is that it's all about planning and communication and awareness. It has nothing to do with logistics and financials, of course, within rationality. Like if you're going now to Sudan, I'm sure you would need a lot of logistical support and funding. But if you don't have the rationality, planning and awareness, you will fail and you will risk yourself and others around. Most people do not understand what is needed for you to really avoid current and potential threats and be able to mitigate them effectively. And they really think too much about the budgeting and the logistics.
I think that's such great advice, especially for small to medium-sized organizations who are functioning in low to no resource environments. And so you emphasized the focus on communications and planning. Can you talk a little bit more about what does that mean? Can you give us some examples or some scenarios that might help relate this to the work that charities and nonprofits might do?
Yes, Sabrina. There are many very clear case studies that we in the security sector use in order to clarify for those who are caring for others that what makes a difference at the end of the day is the skill set. Logistics is an added value, is an added important element, but the main pillar is actually the skill set. So communication, planning, and vigilance and exposure are things that you should have in your standard procedures. One of the most famous case studies that we usually look at is the assassination of President Hariri in Lebanon, such as many other well-known similar incidents where high-profile politicians were assassinated in Pakistan and other countries. Those close protection teams were well-equipped with every piece of technology that can be afforded. Proper convoys, very well-trained close protection officers, very well-armed, and the ability actually to control the environment. You can block streets, open streets, so nothing can go beyond when it comes to spending. Still, they failed. They failed because of the simple stuff that make all the difference. In the case of President Hariri, it was the routine, the lack of ability of the security team to maintain an unpredicted routine for someone as threatened and as high profile as Mr. Hariri is what led to simply being able to allocate the place of the principal and the time where he will be at that specific place. When this is already done, it's simply an equation of how. how can I beat all those logistics? How can I actually overpower whatever they have? So it becomes a matter of budget to the aggressor. That's a very well-known case study that is very interesting to look at. On another side, there's also one more case that people are always interested in speaking about when they speak about smaller groups operating in hostile environments. And it's interesting that we always look at militant groups. Why? Simply because they are always targeted. So if you want to look at an extreme case study of people who are surviving constantly hostile environments, you look at militant groups that are fighting governments. One of the most famous ones is the IRA. The IRA, for example, Green Book, their internal security book, is one of the Bibles of self-preservation for organizations that do analyze internal security procedures. One of the most interesting statements they say is a very well-known cliche, actually, the weakest link concept, that an organization is as strong as its weakest link, which is the individual. And within the Green Book for the IRA, they put a lot of effort concentrating on how aware is the individual of his personal, her personal security, how fast is communication within the organization when potential threat is detected, and how we react if it is a real threat. So learning from the experiences of both governments, militants, and organizations, we come to understand that it's all about how the individual is very well trained and aware of their day-to-day duties, how they are trained to detect sudden changes or alerts, and how fast can they communicate it to the rest of the group so they can all act as a collective. Of course, third parties, organizations, unfortunately, will always have resistance by one person or another because they're affecting change. If you affect change, there's always someone not happy about your work. So being aware of that threat, being able to allocate it, and being aware of yourself and your movement, and make sure that your movement does not make other people's life easy. They can't really detect where you're going, how you're doing things. They can't really see change in day-to-day trends. That's a very, very important skill that needs education, simply education, knowing how to do it, feeling comfortable about it, knowing that it might actually be a very important part of your business continuity and safety. This is a very high level of awareness and a skill that should be gained by many who operate in unstable environments. If you have those, no matter your budget, no matter your logistics, you can always survive the day.
I love how you were saying that even if you are working in a nonprofit, you might assume that you are welcome because you're doing good. Just how you framed that, that a lot of times organizations that are working in these environments are affecting change, and there's always going to be people who don't like that change, is a really interesting point of view that I think a lot of nonprofit workers might not be thinking about. And in some situations, it might raise to a high threat. In other situations, it might not. But it is a perspective to keep in mind that I think is really helpful to keep people safe. Can you talk a little bit more about cultural context and working in unique environments and the importance of understanding that when it comes to physical and personal security?
Definitely, definitely. So Sabrina, what you just said is very much related to this, actually. So a very good question for our colleagues to ask the minute they are starting operating in a new environment and working on a new topic, let's say, is who am I pissing off? Anyone is being affected by what I'm doing? For example, if I'm concentrating on child labor and we are actually doing a very good job here, changing the way things are done, what kind of businesses are actually being affected by a sudden change of labor laws in a specific country? Or if we're working on a specific cause that is related, let's say, to women's rights, are we pressing on a specific cultural aspect that we don't understand? Because one of our biggest problems as humans is that we reflect what we know on others. So you might come with good intentions from a specific country and you have in your mind and heart the belief that you're coming to save a specific segment of the community and that what you say is 100% good. Still, culturally and locally, there is a lot of complexities around it that you don't really see. Things that are similar, for example, to the concept of honor in the Arab world. You've been in the Arab world and you see the Bedouin and tribal culture all over the region. This concept, for example, is much more complicated than what you can think. It's not simply related to sexuality. It's not simply related to females. It goes much beyond. And sometimes it can be very sensitive and it can lead to conflicts among tribes or among people in specific areas that can reach to armed conflicts. But for example, part of our orientation when people come to operate in tribal areas is understanding how the gender-related issues work in specific community and how sensitive they are. One of the most important aspects is being able to see it in real life. So if I tell you that in a Bedouin community, do not approach females and ask her on a date simply because she's being, let's say, kind or seems to show interest because it's more complicated. Things are done in a very official way when it comes to male-female interaction in such communities. Many will have in their mind the image of a traditional Bedouin community. They wouldn't relate this to a very modern-like looking community in Jordan or in Palestine or in Lebanon where females will look very liberal and men will open different discussions. Still, the minute a female shows that she's not comfortable with what a male action is, for example, if you ask a question more than one time, if you physically touch someone, even if in your culture it's an accepted action, in such a city or in such a community, this can lead to dramatic effects. So understanding in depth those communities and understanding the limits and slowly going into a new country's culture is very important. Specifically that you're there feeling that you're coming to change what sometimes people think shouldn't be changed.
I think that's great advice, Hussein. And I think, again, we can take that cultural lens and it may not be somebody coming from Europe going into a Bedouin community. It might just be somebody from a different city going to a different city. And there may be a different way of doing things if you're in the same country. I mean, I'm American and I know if I go from New York City and I go to Houston, Texas, there's going to be different ways of doing things between the state of New York and the state of Texas. And so understanding the culture that you're working in as it relates to safety and security, I think, is such a great point. At one point in my career, I was dabbling in security. And I recall the security triangle, acceptance, deterrence, or protection tactics. And in the humanitarian world in particular, this is something that the security teams tend to balance out a lot. The question of, and this was something that you were talking about a little bit earlier, is high profile versus low profile. So acceptance being, I remember when I was working in a particularly different, I don't want to say difficult, but it was a different environment than I was used to. I chose the acceptance route. And what I did was I went around and I bought boxes of sweets and I took a member of my staff with me who spoke the local language and we went around to the neighbors, the businesses, the houses, and we brought them a box of sweets and we sat down and we explained what we were doing there. And my view was people are going to be less likely to want to break into my facility and steal my resources if they understand who we are and why we're there and why they may see cars coming in and out and what we're doing for the community. And I found that acceptance in that situation served us very well. Because other offices in other parts of the country were getting harassed, they were getting broken in, and we were quite safe because the neighbors knew what was going on. And the neighbors also knew that if there was something that they didn't like, who they could come and talk to. And so I've always kept that point of view. Now, you were talking a little bit earlier about kind of rocking into somewhere with a high profile, right? The armored vehicles, the guys wearing the black wraparound sunglasses with the earpieces and the radios. A lot of small and medium-sized organizations don't have the resources for that, obviously. But what are some things that they can do that might relate to acceptance or awareness and maybe even deterrence and protection that they might be able to do with low to no resources?
First thing, Sabrina, yeah, the approach you took, I think, is definitely the right one. Listening to people before you start speaking with them, giving before you take, and take your time to understand the environment around you, I think is the way to go. Always remember that there are many people around you that have different perspectives and different lenses that they see you through. You might be the Western, you might be the American, you might be the nonprofit organization that not everyone is a fan of. You see yourself one way, but others see you in different ways. And each community have their own stereotypes. Your job, since you're there to affect change, is to be the more understanding party. So you want to educate them on your role and don't expect much from the community around you. Regarding your question, it's very interesting to understand that it's not a matter of budget, actually. It's a matter of understanding what you need. I saw many humanitarian organizations or nonprofits that when they have a bit of a budget, rather than, for example, hiring the right expert who who can help them plan, they would hire the close protection with a concealed gun. You can still have the same approach, even if you don't have enough money. I think having arms around you, having someone who's tactically capable of shooting is not the preliminary security need. Having someone who can break down the role of the organization, the role of the individuals, understand the environment around you, allocate potential threats, and help you plan for your day-to-day operations is what you need. So that's the part we're trying to stress. I don't want to be cliche, but for example, there's something I always remember when we speak about this. Everyone quotes Sun Tzu in Security, so the Art of War. There's a very interesting term there that when you're able to understand yourself, your enemy, and the battlefield, that's when you will always actually be victorious. So it's very interesting because it always reminds us that you have to understand your capability first, your budget, your know-how, and you have to understand the environment and culture, the battlefield or the ground you're operating in. And you have to understand who there is being affected by you and who there might be hostile for your activities, yourselves, and sometimes even for something as simple as your day-to-day habits. Maybe your organization is completely understood in that specific community. You're adding value. People like you. And still, on a personal level, no one has an issue with your nationality or where you come from. But your personal habits in a conservative community, in a village, I don't know where, having an after party at that house at the side of the village every night after finishing work, people moving back home a bit tipsy, that might be perceived as a potential threat for a very conservative community. People might be actually afraid of that attitude because people are not usually that bold. Young men singing loudly while being a bit drunk, sometimes perceived very, very worrying by conservative communities. So sometimes small things that you don't understand can actually dramatically affect your safety and security. That's why that kind of exercise should be done by someone who would be very patient in understanding those three elements: yourself, potential threats, and the ground you're operating in, the culture, the politics, the different players, the governments you're operating under so you don't step on the wrong toes, the community, the geography. So someone should be doing that specific task. And that doesn't need really a big budget. It needs someone who's really smart and patient and will take their time to analyze it and present it in the proper way.
That's fantastic. And I really love what you said in the beginning about how we, as people who are working in a different environment or in a different culture, have to think about the different lenses that people will be looking at us through. And that's a really hard thing to do when you only know yourself from yourself. But you really do have to kind of step back and say, okay, well, yeah, I'm a young woman. And yeah, I'm Western. And yeah, I'm American. And I have an accent. And yeah, this is what I look like. And you really have to force yourself to go through that analysis. But it's very helpful because it can then identify areas that may be vulnerabilities or weaknesses or areas that you need to consider. So I really like that concept of different lenses. And thank you for walking through those elements of analyzing the culture. I like your example very much too of the guest house at night, because I've dealt with that myself in the humanitarian roles that I've been in. You've got guest houses with younger people who work in humanitarian work, and they may be up all night and they might have the lights on and it might not be loud, but it's not what the local community is used to. And being able to have that conversation with your staff so that they understand, look, we are guests here and we need to be on our best behavior is also a really important thing as well.
It can be amazing, Sabrina. Like me, I'm an Arab. I come from a Muslim culture. Still, I misunderstood some cultures in nearby countries and it was going to lead for a bit of a problem. Like an example to give you, I spent some time with some Sufist groups. I wanted really to understand that concept within the culture. I'm not familiar with it. I come from a very liberal family and I became more interested in understanding that at some point. So I spent time with some of them south of Jordan and a few days of isolation to learn what they think, how they act. So men in the Arab culture usually wear the toque, the traditional thing that looks like a bit of like a dress kind of thing. And beneath it, they wear long pants, white long pants that are very thin. So I had some guys perceiving that these are very covered pants. We can just walk around with. And we never thought that they are considered to be like underwear or something. So you lived in a desert-like area. The guys were washing clothes, camping outside, and they were just wearing t-shirts and those pants. And it was a big problem where we were perceived by people from the village. And they said, you're walking around with your underpants.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
And the guy was angry. And I can't connect to that kind of logic. Still, straight away, we contained it. I spoke with the guy. I apologized. I explained that we come from a different place. He's like, you're Arab. How can't you get that? He does not get that. Really, I have never, ever saw this kind of culture. Then the guy with me started explaining that, yes, in some cities, some villages, there's a specific way of doing things. But even us, we can always, if we don't keep an open mind to listen, to observe, not to judge, we can get into trouble.
That's a great example. And what a great story. I'm laughing to myself, but also I can just picture what's happened. Because I've been in those situations too, where you just don't know enough to have a bad intention, but you just step in something or you just make some mistake. And it's just embarrassing and it's offensive. And it's certainly not how you wanted to do it. But yeah, taking that time to understand those cultural elements can really help avoid those things moving forward. So this actually takes me to my next question. We talked about contextual elements, how to plan, how to communicate, being aware of how people may be viewing your work or who you are as an individual. What would you say are the top three risk areas for physical and personal security in the third sector that organizations need to be aware of?
I would say that it all goes back to the individual. So I believe the biggest slippery slope in the third sector is that people come to operate in a risky area, let's say. We assume that we're in some kind of a unstable environment. They come self-motivated. So, for example, the difference between an engineer who come with an oil and gas company to dig wells in Libya is that they already come there for the task. They already come there for the job, and they're not really excited about being in the middle of the desert doing that. They take the brief from the security director and they just abide by every step in. If they say you can't cross that line, they won't cross that line because they don't want to know what's behind that line. When it comes to humanitarian agencies or activists, most of the time people come because either they want to actually help on a specific cause, they believe in it, or at least they're interested in knowing something new and living something new and meeting the people in a different place of the world. So that kind of people are always in higher risks because they are self-motivated to either be more involved with the people they meet or to know more. And from there, first thing, personal security becomes really problematic because when you want to meet people, you want to share your contacts, you want them on your social media, you want to have pictures, you want to go out with them, you want to see how they spend their nights, and you want to go on trips with them. I've been there, done that with most of the humanitarian communities that I interacted with. They're really hungry to know more. And the minute they leave the office, most of us would like to believe that this is me time. It's my rules now. And it's very important to remember that there's no such thing. If you're representing a specific organization in a specific environment that have some uniqueness, you have always to remind yourself that there's no such thing as it's my time outside the office, because most of the big problems that occurred in my career specifically were people that acted with much less diligence during their personal time. It's that when you get the phone call that someone did something wrong or someone was caught on video doing something that is culturally not accepted in a specific environment, and he was tagged or she was tagged as a humanitarian, for example, activist at a specific organization. So from a night out, it turns into a crisis management procedure for the coming week to speak to the local community about the specific. It can be something very simple, as you said. But when you put the logo of your organization on that, it doesn't look as good. So that's, I think, the main pillar, how people perceive themselves and their duty. And from there, we start building the other two issues, the other two main problems. So first one is personal security and awareness. Second one is your analysis tool, how you analyze the culture and the country around you. Most of the times, people are surrounded by those who are from the same community. Even if you are working with locals, those locals do work for humanitarian organizations, maybe middle, upper class, educated technicians or professionals, and they do believe in similar things to what you believe as well. They work for the same organization, for the same cause, and we have a problem in many communities that they want to make you feel welcomed. They want to have you at home. They want to show you the liberal side of the country, the acceptance within the country, because it's a feeling that they want you to accept them as individuals and as a collective. In my opinion, this is one of the biggest problems that we face as security people. Because even if the country is really not stable at a specific stage, locals put a lot of effort to make the internationals feel safe in that environment. And that's where our risk assessment mechanism become imprecise and debates start. And security personnel are always being accused of being too dramatic and conservative when it comes to analysis. I think this is a big issue as well.
All right. So the two that you have is personal security and awareness. And I like the example that you gave. If you're wearing the t-shirt of the organization that you're working for and you're going out and doing something questionable, then it's a problem for everybody. And then the second one is, and I like this one too, that how you do your personal analysis, how you view the local community. That's a really, again, looking at these things from a slightly different perspective. I really like that.
Yes, definitely. This applies almost to everything. So when you come, for example, to work with a specific government and you're dealing with the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Minister of Foreign Affairs will facilitate everything and will make everything look easy, fast, and simple. If you step in a different field where Minister of Interior have to deal with you, they will be more worried about what you're messing up within their work while operating in that specific field. So always people who facilitate your operations in a specific country or community would make things look easier and more comfortable. And you always forget about the people who are not interacting with you. Usually problems, threats, or hazards come from those who are monitoring, but they're not happy. They're not interacting. They don't belong to that circle you're daily operating in. And it takes someone to be fully dedicated on full time to be able to allocate those, because you're very much busy with your day-to-day work and PR and networking among who are like-minded or among who are working for the same goal you are working for. And you forget that those are like, I don't know, 1% of the community and the country you're in. But someone's job should be zooming out and analyzing structure and the activity that is happening on a daily basis.
So let me ask you this question then. If someone is listening today, and they're thinking about the work that their organization is doing, and they're saying, you know, I really think that we need to improve our structure around personal security, security awareness, physical security. What are some ways that they could make a strong business case for more resources or more attention around this area? What are the benefits that an organization will receive if they pay attention to this type of work? Now, again, remember, the organizations that we're talking about have low to no resources. So if someone wants to make a business case for minimal resources that they can get, what are the positives? What's the benefits that people get if they're focusing on this area?
So I don't think anyone affords not to approach security the way we're describing it. And I don't think problems will or will not happen. I think it's a matter of time when something that will happen and affect your operations. It might be something very small. You might not even relate it to security. It might be exposure. It might be hiring the wrong person or funding the wrong person. If you don't build your organization based on a security understanding, which let's say we can call an awareness understanding, if you don't want to use security, because if you don't build that, you will do mistakes in a continuously changing environment. For example, case studies that we've looked at during the last few years, including different security mistakes, had affected closing complete projects because due diligence wasn't made, for example, on a specific organization that was funded by an international organization. And apparently it was politically affiliated and there was a lot of issues around it in the local community. So the minute this went out to press, it dramatically affected that project and it shut down. Yeah. This had to do with having no one in that office saying, by the way, what's our due diligence process before funding someone with $100K when you get suddenly funding for a specific project? So the main thing, I'm giving just random different examples to just understand that it's not simply physical security. It's a whole layer that should be in every action within the organization. The main fear would be business continuity. That's number one, in my opinion. Another, for example, organizations that were dramatically affected as well are organizations who did not provide the right information for their employees. So you're operating in a country that once every while you hear of, let's say, a militant attack or aggressive incident, and you don't really provide real-time security information to everyone on the ground. And one of those companies that we're currently working with, since they don't have such a channel, five of their employees were just very close to a first attack that happened. The second one actually was within the area they were having their coffee and four of them lost their lives. Since then, they have a minimum accepted budget of security that is stopping them from going into many countries because they can't always secure it. They overreacted to the event with money, which I think is really not necessary. Having a simple duty of care understanding and embedding it within the organizational culture is priceless. Knowing that I can't send anyone to any country without giving them access to the right information that will secure their day-to-day operations and well-being is a right. This should always be part of what I offer to those I'm sending on my missions. Access to information, providing them with the right level of awareness to be able to deal with the culture, with the politics, and with any current or potential threats is a right. They should expect it from you, and it would need sharing information. It would need an expert that would be there to train them, to tell them what to do, what not to do. That same expert can also provide them with a contingency plan. So it's three main layers. They have always access to information of anything happening around them. They understand the environment and the threats surrounding them. And they know what to do if things go wrong. Those are the minimum, in my opinion, three main pillars that any organizations should place in any operation they have across the world. And people should demand them. They should demand that they have the right know-how. They know what's happening around them. They have the contingency plan in place. And there's someone they can call when they don't feel comfortable. That's the minimum. And I don't think this needs a budget. I think this needs intentions. I saw many organizations giving such duties to someone who's not necessarily the best security expert, but they had to do the research. They had to bring someone to train. They had to put a document in place. And if there is specific aspects they couldn't build themselves, they would bring an outsourced expert or rely on other organization that provides free of charge security services for nonprofits. I don't know if in most countries they exist, but for example, in the West Bank, I know of three of them. In Jordan, I know of two of them. And the organization can always bring those expertise to the table with efforts. If you don't have the budget, you can put the efforts. You can communicate with people. You can ask someone like Hussein to give free time to support a specific cause, specific group of people operating in a challenging environment, or you can ask specific organizations to lend you their expertise for a week. I'm sure international organizations, humanitarian organizations, if approached by smaller ones, asking only for the security know-how, just come for a week, help us draft our contingency plan, help us train our staff, tell us where can we get open source intelligence from if we don't have someone that we can pay for it. So how can we actually utilize it? I think international organizations will look very bad if you ask them for only the know-how, 7 days out of their time, and they say, sorry, we can't help you learn how to secure your personnel. So we should become smarter on getting what we want, specifically when money is an issue. The human interaction should solve it. Intentions should solve it. Leadership within your organizations should be held accountable to actually push this forward. And I said, even if budgets are a problem, just with efforts.
I really like how you said it's not about security, it's about awareness. And I think if you frame it that way, and again, understanding the duty of care that organizations have, but if we frame it as in its awareness and not security, you approach the topic in such a different way. I mean, I won't name the organization that I was with, but I remember I was being deployed to a particular area. And I joke around that my security briefing at the headquarters before I was deployed was, as I like to say, a series of grunts that the security officer said. So, you know, we're sitting around a table, we're all new employees, and someone says, oh, where are you going? And they go, oh, well, I'm going to, you know, Cote d'Ivoire. Oh, okay, okay. You know, where are you going? I'm going to Iraq. Oh, okay. You know, where are you going? I'm going to Jordan. Oh, you know, and that was it, right? It was just, you know, it wasn't, this is the context, this is the culture, this is help, you know, things to keep in mind when you're moving from here to there. It was just, oh, okay, well, you know, good luck. Yeah. And that's not really helpful for anybody. So I really like looking at it as, what do you need to know? Awareness. What do you need to learn about the communities that you're going to be working within to really then help feed into your safety and security planning? So I think that's such a great point of view. This is a similar question. They're going back to what you were talking about, the duty of care that organizations have. This is a question about board members in particular. So if you are advising board members of a small to medium-sized organization on personal safety and physical security, board members a lot of times for these organizations are not very experienced. They're volunteers. They may have never been on a board before. They love the organization. Their heart is in the purpose and the mission of the organization, but they just really aren't sure how to be a board member. So if you were advising a board, what are things that they can do, questions that they can ask, information that they can request to really demonstrate their support for this concept of safety and security awareness and fulfilling the organization's duty of care that they have towards not only their employees, but also their volunteers and the beneficiaries that they're working with? What advice do you have for board members?
I like to hold board members responsible to be the rational actor within a humanitarian organization or a charity. I would like to believe that for a charity, let's say, to be productive, to actually grow and affect change, you need different kind of people. So activists on the ground should be motivated, should be active, should be very excited. And we always expect that that kind of personality who will travel and put the hard work and sometimes be underpaid still want to change and believe in the cause. Those are the ones who me as a security expert would worry from, because they are the ones affecting change for you. They are the engine. And the more you do, the highest the margin of error, the more mistakes you might do. But for the board members, planning, strategizing, even if you're not an expert on being a board member, even if you're simply someone who believes in the cause, as you said, you can put a lot of time and effort from wherever you're sitting to be the person making sure everyone is taking the right measures. The first question they should be asking when approving a specific activity is, what are the risks? You're the person to ask that question. The manager on the ground, the activist on the ground might not ask that question. So it should start being part of every document that is submitted to the board. What are the risks? And how are we mitigating them? That's the first two questions they should ask out of responsibility. Even if you come from the same environment as the activist, you have to know that your task is to be responsible for whatever others are not asking. The third question that they should bring an answer to, what can we do if we don't have the right budget? And that, I think, where initiatives will start. I think board members will be the people who will push towards opening connections, networks, with those who can collaborate to provide you with the right information. I think board members might be the people who would send other board members at other organizations who have been there, done that, ask them for their own contingency plan or for their own threat assessment so they can build on it. If you bring me a document that did the threat assessment for, let's say, East Jerusalem last year, I can work on it in half the budget, half the effort, and I can understand the context within a specific year. So such intention to take these things seriously and find ways around budgets and money, I think that's where the board should step in and open network with others who can help.
I think that's great advice. And that's really very helpful, clear direction and steers for new or potentially nervous third sector board members. Thank you for that, Hussein. So the next question I want to ask you is, if people are listening today and they're interested in learning more about what does awareness mean, how do they learn more about cultural environments that they're working in or these concepts of security that you've been talking about? What is some continuing education material that they can access? Again, hopefully it is low to no resource friendly, so it's not too expensive. But are there websites that they can visit, articles that they can read, other podcasts that they can listen to, things that they can reference if they want to establish or strengthen the physical security and awareness environment within their organization? What would you recommend?
Frankly, I think there's a very big difference between know people and do people. So I can do a PhD in physical security, let's say, and have theories that I can implement in different cases. But I don't think people within organizations on the ground have the time or the luxury to go through long educational approaches. And I think the best thing they can do is learning proactive approaches, which is keeping themselves familiar with those who already are operating on the ground in the area specifically they are interested in. So don't go too general. Don't go and look for theories or books, but have on your browser, for example, if you're in the West Bank, have the UNRWA on your browser. Have OCHA, who actually would go and release statistics and information and very, very useful maps on checkpoints, recent attacks, or whatever is happening across the whole country once every 2 weeks. So make your research to understand who's already on the ground doing the job you should be doing. For example, if a low-budget organization is operating in, for the sake of conversation, let's say the West Bank, there's a lot of challenges you need to know of. What we call flying checkpoints that pop up suddenly, attacks, new trends, military maneuvers. Today, for example, we're seeing rocket launching between Gaza and Israel. And all of these are events that are happening constantly. You need 10 people to be able to report to everyone where to go, where not to go. Still, you don't really need that. Because if you do a simple research, you recognize that the UNDSS will provide you access to SMS on everything that's happening free of charge if you are a nonprofit. They give you two numbers, and then you can just reshare that information. OCHA sends you once every 2 weeks. There is AIDA, which is actually a group of different nonprofit organizations that have security directors on board that would happily give you advice if you need it without actually having to pay anything. And having simply a local person who speaks very well English to collect all those information, send them to the right people on the ground at the right time, asking them to check in wherever they are back home, making sure they don't go to specific routes that already OCHA has told you about and the UNDSS has reported and many others share, would be extremely effective. You will utilize everyone's research, everyone's input into your small organization through having one person just managing that information and reorganize it.
Can I ask you a similar question?
Yes.
So you're talking about having these resources from the UN or local security or even just the news, right? I mean, seeing what's going on and where and how's it happening. But how do you then get your staff? I mean, you could send this to the right person and they could disseminate it through WhatsApp or emails or whatever. How do you build that kind of culture of security awareness among the staff to get them to say, okay, these are the things that I can learn about and I could do, but how do you get them to really internalize it so it's things that they're doing instead of just things that they're knowing about?
When you want to be as effective as possible, you need to take into consideration the nature of the organization. So if you're a 5 people's office, or are you a 35 people's office? It makes a big difference when it comes to the culture. In my opinion, there always have to be a very clear, written, expected procedure that people have to sign on. People have to know that this is part, it's a very serious part of the organization culture, and that it has to do with the safety and security of the personnel and business continuity. In my opinion, in the first week, case studies should be presented. People need to sense the size of the threat, that minimum, things might affect the continuity of this project in a specific place if you're not aware enough, if you're not careful enough. And then phase by phase, you upgrade your command and control mechanism, because it doesn't always work when you're dealing with humanitarians or charities. People, as I said, are self-motivated. They have their own way of looking at stuff. So they need to be convinced. And in my opinion and experience, case studies is the best way to show people how important it is. If you find resistance at some point, that's when you start implementing procedures. Check-in, location check in times of emergency. You give the responsibility to a specific person who needs to make sure that everyone is in place. You give, of course, as well warnings, and you take things very seriously if misconduct happens. So it becomes as important as anything else within your organization that people don't really do, because there will be problems if you don't abide by them.
I like how you mentioned, instead of just saying, we'll lock you down, we'll punish you, all those things, which tend to be ignored or maybe very lightly adhered to. I liked what you mentioned earlier, where you said tie it to the effectiveness of the project and say, look, if this happens, we won't be able to implement this project. And then all of these people are not going to benefit from the project that we're there to implement. And so instead of being a threat to the staff, because we know, like you were mentioning, humanitarian workers are their own type of people, like fairly independent sometimes, but really everyone's heart and head is in the project, is making sure it's a success and is bringing that positive impact to the community that they're serving. And so if you tie the security elements back to, look, if you screw up, we're not going to be able to serve these people anymore, that might be even more effective than threatening them with lockdown or discipline.
And it takes out the debate, because, you know, I've been in those offices. We had those debates for long, and someone sometimes stands up and say, I know this community better than anyone else. I've been serving for 5 years in this country. I actually went into their houses. I know what they need and I trust them. So please, don't compromise the effectiveness of my project by putting more barriers or more layers on how we do things. So if you start by showing that what we are doing from a security perspective is to eliminate threat towards this project, you don't open this debate. Because the most dangerous thing is to start having a two camps debate inside an office where one wants to show that we are bold and more committed to the cause, and the others become bureaucrats who really are more office people. That happens a lot in a humanitarian organization. And you need to start from day one showing that, no, we both go in one line. For us to sustain the project, for us to reach our goal, we can't take risks. And that's when anyone who wants to go out of the security understanding would look more of a hectic person rather more of a revolutionary person. And that's what you want.
I think that's such great advice. Thank you for that, Hussein. I appreciate it. So we've come towards the end of our time today. Before we close out, is there anything that we didn't cover? Do you have any more bits of wisdom for organizations that are trying to tackle this challenge?
Just at the end of our talk, I would like to advise everyone that if you look for someone who should step in to implement such procedures, if you're looking for a security expert or someone who would play the role, because as we said, sometimes you don't really have a budget for that, always look for someone who is at the top of the scale when it comes to commitment to the cause. One other problem we see on a daily basis is that we bring an ex-military security expert who has never been there or done that. And that's when the security sound within the office sounds like very alien from the other people, or as you said, from the code of the project. And that's when you start getting resistance. That's why you either find someone within the community with security expertise, or you also train your security person on the importance of what you're doing, on how people perceive it. So they start building a way of communicating with others that will be accepted and related to the end goal. Because the minute we sound like authority, everyone resists.
That's wonderful. Great. Thank you so much for your time today, Hussein. I really appreciate it. We've covered so much information and you've given just some great advice and guidance for charities and nonprofits who are looking at, addressing, concerned about, and working on their physical and personal security. Before we go, where can people find you, Hussein? So if people are listening today, and they're interested in reaching out to you and they want to learn more about you or the work that you do, how can people get in touch with you?
I'm always open to help and to chat about any issues anyone have in mind related to my line of work. And I think the best way is through LinkedIn. I believe that's the best way. I'm always active there and I respond at the same day.
Excellent. Wonderful. So thank you again so much for your time today, Hussein. Really appreciate it. Learned a lot. And you've provided a lot of really, really, really great advice and tangible advice and practical advice for small to medium-sized organizations. So thank you.
Thank you. Have a good day.
So that's our show for today. Please remember to like, subscribe, and follow us for all your third sector risk information. Thanks for listening to Tolerable Risk.